She told me that she was worried about me there for a minute. She thought I was getting ready to teach heaven going. She said when I had the slide up there with the two ways, she said when I was speaking about the foolishness of taking that broad road, that I said, for heaven's sake, don't take that one. It wasn't the sake of going to heaven. Please believe that. It's strange how the old sayings come to us in the most inappropriate settings. Well, as we closed out the last 50 minutes, we were considering the walk, the attitudes that we should have as the servants of God, and how people should be able to look at us and tell that we really are preparing to receive the reward that will soon be dispensed at the judgment seat of Christ. Because we're living on a planet that is in serious trouble. As we pointed out a few moments ago, the problems that confront this age without the intervention of God, we wouldn't survive. Man would destroy himself. If the ozone layer itself continued to dissipate, the heat and cold upon it would make finally life impossible on the earth. But we know that when the power of God is throughout this earth, manifested through the company of immortal saints, that the problems which now confront the nations will find solutions. Because the scriptures say that with thee, that is God, nothing is impossible. And the saints being a manifestation of God, as his son certainly was and is, the power of God may be used by them, shall be used by them, to solve all of these problems which men and their mortality have found it impossible to solve. As we stand here today, we are facing the return of Christ and the imminence of his judgment seat. Let's look at Ecclesiastes, the 12th chapter. Verses 13 and 14. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandment, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Now this is true whether it concerns the persons of the covenanted, and we'll notice that in a separate consideration in a few moments. But we want to now go to the 149th Psalm, because when we think of the term judgment, we must not always consider it to be referring to the tribunal before which the servants of God will appear. This entire earth is set for the judgments of God. And when this time comes, the slain of the Lord shall be from one end of this earth to the other. 149th Psalms. Praise ye the Lord. Sing unto the Lord a new song and his praise in the congregation of saints. What might that new song be? In the fourth chapter of the Revelation, there is a series of visions that are shown to the Apostle John. The first verse says he heard a voice in heaven, not off up into space somewhere, but we have every reason to believe that this is the new heaven and new earth that Peter spoke of in 2 Peter 3:13. when after he had spoken of the heaven and earth which were before the flood, which were standing in and out of the water and perished, and the heavens and earth which are now, which he says are reserved unto fire and the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. Then in verse 13 he says, we according to his promise look for a new heaven and a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness. And right away, I'm sure we all recognize that this is the third heaven to which Paul said in 2 Corinthians 12 that he had been caught up to third heaven and had seen things that were unlawful to utter. That's a biblical way of saying something so beautiful, so glorious, that it wasn't possible to describe it. No wonder he said in 1 Corinthians 2 and 9, eye hath not seen nor ear heard, neither hath it entered into the heart of men, the thing that God hath prepared for those that love him. So in that fourth chapter of the Revelation, he sees a throne set and one upon it like an Adam stone, a son of Adam, but was like a jasper stone also, clear as crystal, speaking of a son of Adam clothed upon with immortality. And he saw 24 elders before that throne, 4 living creatures, which are but 2 different symbols, the 24 elders and the 4 living creatures, or the 4 cherubim, both of these symbols representing the saints of God and their immortality. And in from verses 8 through 10, they are represented as saying, thou art worthy. Now it says they sang a new song. Psalms 149 starts out with this song in the congregation of saints. They sang a new song saying, thou art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof, for thou wast slain and hast redeemed us by thy blood out of every nation, kindred, people, and tongue, and hath made us unto our God kingdom, a kingdom and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. It says kings and priests, but there will be one king over all the earth and many princes and priests. So there is that new song, which is, it says here, to sing unto the Lord that new song, and it's sung by the redeemed. Let Israel rejoice in him who made him. Let the children of Zion be joyful in their king. Let them praise his name in the dance. Let them sing praises unto him with a timbrel and harp. For the Lord taketh pleasure in his people. He will beautify the meek with salvation. Let the saints be joyful in glory. You see, we, by that time, will have become like Christ, and this is according to promise. Let them sing aloud upon their beds. Let the high praises of God be in their mouth and a two-edged sword in their hand. During that age, throughout the age, there is a two-edged sword in the hands of the saints, and Paul speaks of this in Hebrews 4:12, and he says, for the word of God is a two-edged sword, and says it is capable of dividing us under soul, spirit, and the joints of the marrow, and so forth, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. But there will be literal destruction that will be spread wide by the immortal saints, who will go forth in the name of their Redeemer with the authority of his Father, and who will rid the earth of every unclean, unsightly, an undesirable thing that has no right to exist in such a perfect age. Let the high praises of God be in their mouth and a two-edged sword in their hand to execute vengeance upon the nations and punishments upon the people. Now, in Isaiah, the 26th chapter, There is a prophecy of the resurrection in verse 19 when it says, "Thy dead shall live together with my dead body, shall they arise, awake and sing, ye that dwell in the dust, for the earth shall cast out the dead." And it goes on to speak of, "For the time of my vengeance is come. Hide thyself as for a moment until my vengeance is upon these on the nations." Well, here we find that that vengeance is poured out as God has done with everything except the original creation many eons ago. He has done everything since, seemingly, through his agents, either the immortal angels, sometimes through his mortal servants upon the earth. But his immortal servants will execute his vengeance upon the nations, following their great general, our elder brother, the Messiah of Israel and our Redeemer, to bind their king with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron. So every work will be brought into judgment, whether it concerns our probationary period or whether it concerns the nations upon the earth and the people that constitute them. In a way, every individual upon the face of the earth is on probation. Now, be careful to understand what I'm saying. Not on probation to life eternal, but God will weigh the facts as to whether a person is worthy, even though he's not under covenant, to live in a time such as the kingdom will be, when the word shall go forth from Jerusalem and the law from Zion, and when man will be seeking after the Lord to seek immortality in that time. Truly, that is a time of back to Eden. Eden was lost by Adam. It is regained by the second Adam. And when we are back to Eden, does not that seventh verse of chapter 2 of Revelation clearly tell us that that tree of life is once again there for those on probation to eat of it at the end of their probation, as Adam and Eve would have been permitted to had they not sinned before their probation was over? So during the kingdom age, certainly, those who are left will be seeking life eternal, just as Adam and Eve were given the opportunities to acquire it in their time. Had they been successful, we wouldn't be here today. There would have not been the succeeding 7 or 6 millenniums before we entered Eden again, because it would have continued as it was. But sadly, sin entered, and there are consequences to sin. And we do well to remember this today. It's just as true with us as it was Adam and Eve. We're on probation for life or death. The world is on probation for the right to live under a righteous government and in an age where life can still be obtained by the mortals. There will be many on the face of this earth, as we stated before, that surely are not worthy of that chance, because their lives are so full of the filth and the corruption that is throughout this earth. Our young people may very well be on probation with a view to whether they, if they are obedient to their parents and attentive to the word, as to whether God considers them apt subjects for his kingdom to live and to learn of his way and redemption and to acquire it inside the kingdom. All isn't lost for our young people, and we need to make that clear to them in all of our lectures and our classes, that the fact that they are not in covenant when the end of this age comes does not mean that they have missed it. Because the next age will be much more glorious. Jeremiah 3:17 says, "In that time they shall call Jerusalem the throne of the Lord. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and they shall walk no more after the imagination of an evil heart." In the 54th and the 60th of Isaiah, the 65th and 66th chapters, beautiful portraits are painted of the kingdom age when he said, "Thy children shall all be taught righteousness." And back there again in Isaiah, the 26th chapter, it is said, "When thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants thereof will learn righteousness." What do they learn today? Well, if they just watch their television sets, they don't learn righteousness. There's not much of it there. And in the schools, they don't learn righteousness because righteousness is not godless. There was a time when God was recognized in the schools. But try mentioning him in a class today and see how unpopular you become. This says a lot about the civilization of the closing days of this sixth millennium. The Apostle Paul says, "We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that every one may receive for the things done in his body, according to that which he hath done, whether it be good or bad." Yes, he'll bring every work into judgment. In the 5th chapter of John, we're told that God judgeth no man, but he hath attributed all judgment unto his Son. He hath committed it all unto him. It is to him we must answer. He's the one that showed us the way and told us how to walk in those footsteps. And it is he who will sit as the judge to reveal to us the kind of race we actually did run. And when that time comes, when that tap on the shoulder actually comes, what will be our feelings? Will we wish with all of our being that we could back up several weeks, perhaps months, and redo some things? I'm sure all of us will. And some will desperately need to. Without the grace of God, none of us will make it. And so I dare say none of us will get that tap on the shoulder and the message that it is time to go to the judgment seat without a feeling of, "Gee, I wish I had done this or that differently." You know, now's the time to start. Because just as certainly as we're sitting here today, that judgment seat is going to be a reality. For these 2,000 years after the gospel was unfolded and began to shine brightly, after the great light came, the subject of the judgment seat has made very good subject matter for lectures and classes. But it no longer will be a matter for study when that tap on the shoulder comes. Then that which was subject matter will be a reality. Let us turn to the 17th chapter of Luke, because there's some things there we want to consider. And as we take notice of this, we will also notice that there's a characterization of this sixth millennium and the close of it, which corresponds to some times in biblical history. Verse 26, Luke 27, says, "As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the Son of Man. They did eat, they drank, they married wives. They were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. Is it so wrong to eat, to drink? Well, yes, that can be very bad. But perhaps eat and drink can be done in such a manner. I drink tea. Maybe it's not talking about tea. But they ate and drank. They married wives. There's nothing wrong with that. We all marvel and we celebrate when our young people get married to a fellow believer. They did all this until Noah entered into the ark. What is the message here? It occupied their entire attention. They had no time for God. And when you get away from the precepts of God, the farther you stray from them, the farther into depravity you go. And this is a lesson that I dare say that we don't keep before us nearly enough. And it's no wonder that the Apostle Paul said in the 10th chapter of Hebrews, verses 24 and 25, "Let us love one another and provoke to love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves as the manner of some is." And he says, you know, so much more, this loving one another as the day approaches. You know, we need each other on a regular basis. If we don't rub shoulders with each other, with those of like precious faith, we rub shoulders with the other, with the people of the world. And those with whom we rub shoulders, it tends to rub off on us. If we're with those of like precious faith, perhaps the conversation will be on a good plane, and our thoughts on a high level. Not so with our worldly friends. You know, seeking to be friends of the world, and we can't do it, but though many of us try, I'm sure, is a dangerous thing. Friendship with the world, the scriptures say, is enmity with God. Paul said in Romans 12, not to be conformed to this world. Be conformed to Christ. And I'm going to share with you an analogy that I took from a Reader's Digest a number of years ago. And my apology to those of our ecclesia, because I used this last Sunday in my lecture. But there was an analogy there. To me, it was an analogy, and I've used it many times. And if you've heard it before, forgive me, but I don't feel that I would be justified in not using it. There was a very wealthy man who for years had a trusted chauffeur. He knew that he always obeyed the law. He was careful. His driving ability was impeccable. He never had any fear, as long as he was chauffeured by this individual. But as happened, the chauffeur grew old and wanted to retire. So he told his employer to be looking about for someone else, because on such and such a date he could begin drawing his Social Security and he would like to no longer be employed. And so the employer put an ad in the paper, in several papers, and received a number of applications for that job. And finally, he had narrowed it down to 3 applicants. And it came down to a very difficult stage, because here he had 3 who were equally qualified. So one day he called them all together and said, "There is one final test. I must test your driving skills." And he said, "Let's all get in the back seat of my limousine and I'll have my chauffeur drive us all out there." So they arrived at the point, and over a little way was a cliff that was about 200 feet high, and of course they were up on a plateau above it. The wealthy man said, "Now I want to know from each of you how close, before I let you demonstrate it, I want to know how close you feel that you could get the right front wheel to this cliff and still not go over to destruction." Well, one gentleman said, "Why, I wouldn't be a bit afraid to come within 2 feet of it." He said, "I always know where the wheels are." So he looked at the second gentleman and says, "How about you, sir?" He says, "He thinks that's good." He says, "I could come within 6 inches of that cliff and still not go over." And he looked at the third gentleman and said, "What about you, sir?" He says, "I'm sorry." He said, "I desperately need this job." But he said, "If I have to risk my life and yours in order to get it, hire one of them." He said, "Sir, you're hired." Which one of these gentlemen would be our pattern as we live our life in Christ? The one who was willing to see how close to the lion he could drive or walk, as our case might be in our race. Do we stay as far from the lion that might take us over to destruction if our momentum was such? And believe me, in the world, our momentum can get worse than what we thought if we get too involved in this world, because there are many desirable things out there: the shiny cars, the high-paying jobs, the office parties. The list is unending, and if we're not careful, we move farther away from the narrow way into the broad way, and the momentum carries us over the cliff to destruction. How wise we are if we're like the third gentleman, who under no circumstances would drive within 1,000 yards of that cliff. If we stay as far away from the lion which separates the way of Christ from the way of the world, we no doubt will hear, "Come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world." I would hope every one of us would be deathly scared of that lion and stay a long way from it. When that time comes and the tap on the shoulder comes, there will be various and sundry circumstances. We spoke of an uncovenanted person earlier, married to a believer. Let's continue there in Luke 17 now and see what it says about various people. Verse 28, "Also as it was in the days of Lot, they did eat, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed." In other words, the danger is in going about daily things without our proper attention paid to the things of God. "In that day," verse 31, "let him that shall be upon the housetop and his stuff in the house not come down to take it away. Let him also that is in the field not return." Is it possible that when that call comes and we're at work, we may think of that shiny car that's in the garage and want to make proper disposal? Might we think of some possession, a diamond ring or something, that we fear that thieves will break in and and steal while we have been taken away. Those things aren't worth thinking of. We're told in 2 John 2:15 through 18, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of God is not in him. For all that is in the world is the lust of the flesh, the pride of life, and the lust of the eye, and is not of God, but of the world. And he says in verse 18, the world passeth away in the lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. That simply says that this world and its goods are coming to an end. Not civilization. There will always be a civilization upon this earth. But the world that now exists, the cosmos, the order of things upon it is set for destruction. The only thing of any importance when that time comes is what will be the judgment rendered when I stand before the judgment seat of Christ. There will not be a lot of difference between us and the man that is on trial in a court of law today. And the jury has come and taken their seat. And the judge says to the foreman of the jury, how do you find this man or this woman? I'm sure we will wait as urgently and as nervously as the person does who is waiting for the verdict of the jury as we stand there. But as the tap on the shoulder comes from the believer, look at verse 35, even 34, I tell you, in that night there shall be two men in one bed. One shall be taken, the other left. Why would one be taken, the other left? One is a son of Adam, the other is the son of God, and the son of God is subject to the judgment seat of Christ, while the son of Adam has no part, has had no part in the things of God because he did not choose to have, and therefore remains when the covenanted person is taken. Two women shall be grinding together. One shall be taken and the other left. Two men shall be in the field. One shall be taken and the other left. You know, an uncovenanted person married to a believer may be at work. They may be in the home and the uncovenanted one, rather vice versa. And that afternoon it may become quite clear to the uncovenanted one, well, I wonder where my mate is. And they may wait into the night. The police may be called. And the police say, I'm sorry, we can't help you at this point. Try it and see. They'll tell you, if you have a child that doesn't come home, they'll tell you, no, so much time has to go by before we can kick into action. So that believer may wonder, that unbeliever, uncovenanted one, they may believe that this is the truth, but for some reason or other, has not seen fit to make that covenant and to lay hold on that precious reward that's soon coming. And really, what has the person done? And we in the covenant had better think about this too. This precious reward that is so near in the future. We might compare that to a train 100 miles long, loaded with fine gold. And we come upon a half-ton pickup full of scrap iron, and stop and trade that fine gold for that worthless iron. That's just about what we are doing with the short time that's left to remain out of covenant, or if we're in covenant, to be friends with the world to the detriment of our walk in the truth. It's like trading a long train of precious gold and jewels for a small truck full of worthless scrap iron. The word fool would aptly apply here. Be worse than the man that said there was no God, to believe that there is a God, and yet with just a little bit of time left to fail to lay hold on it. When that tap on the shoulder comes, I may not be home. I may be off on the road somewhere. I don't know if we'll get together, if my wife and I will get together at the judgment. All of us may be separated by a few hundred yards, a few miles, or several states. Possibly we will look for each other at the judgment. We will no doubt see people there that we've buried. We'll see men we may wonder. I wonder if that could be Abraham. Because there will be a great throng of people there from these 6,000 years waiting to go before the judgment seat. We may recognize from the picture that this man is John Thomas. Robert Roberts. We will look and maybe recognize Janet Brown. Ted O'Kelly. O.L. Dunaway. But most important of all, the Son of God. You know, we may get very polite as we get closer to the judgment seat and ask, would you like to go first? Something to think about. We may see a large crowd growing over here, off on the left of the Savior. On his left would be over here, though, wouldn't it? If we're facing him. And a crowd growing slower on his right. The growth is slower because the road to destruction had been broader. And we'll begin to wonder which of those roads we had traveled. We may see one individual go to the right and we may scratch our head. He went to the right? I was sure. We may say, well, Lord, don't you know how he was? Don't you know how I had to talk about him all through the brotherhood and tell everybody how he was? So that they'd be sure and not use him? Well, I had to destroy his reputation to keep things that he believed from being preached. And you approve, and as he gets to the word approve, he may stop. Wait a minute. If he was approved, I wonder if I will not be approved. You know, one of the strongest points that's made in the scriptures, 25th chapter of Matthew, inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of these my brethren, you have done it unto me. To the righteous, Christ had said to him, I was sick and you came to me. I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was in prison and you visited me. Why, Lord, when did we do that? He says, inasmuch as you did it unto the least of one of these, my brethren, you did it unto me. What we do to one another, we have done to Christ. If we have done good to one another, we have done good to Christ. If we have destroyed a brother and his reputation, we have done the same to Christ. And it will be at the judgment waiting for us. And as we ourselves step forward to the judgment seat, we may need help to take that final step. And the awesome reality of that moment, when we look and we see the individual that we have so long spoken of the imminent of his return, and suddenly we're standing in his presence. Have any of us ever written a book? Some of us have, I'm sure. But every one of us has written at least one chapter in a book. And it's mentioned in the fourth chapter of Malachi. It's the book of remembrance. We wrote a chapter with our life. Whether it's committed to his memory or a literal book, we know not. But there's one thing for certain. Whether it's memory or words written down, it will be unerringly accurate. As we see his eyes descend to the pages, we may wonder, I wonder if he's looking at the event I'm thinking about. Our minds may race back and forth over our life, seeking as many good things as we can remember. Though there may be many, we probably can only think of the bad ones, the ones we'd rather forget and would hope are not written down. As he lifts his eyes to ours, and we know we're about to give account, either for a good race or one that was not so good, we will realize that truly we're on trial, just as sure as any criminal that ever lived, because we're all sinners and sin is a crime. Our future will truly at that time be in the balance. Some will feel incredible joy as he points to the right. Many will feel desperate sorrow. Those who go to the right will feel a rush of strength as mortality gives way to immortality. Those on the left may see a flash of light as that company is energized with the Spirit of God. And their desperation will be overwhelming. But think of the joy of having the power of God to be of a nature that nothing, no power, no device of man could even scathe you, much less destroy your life. How many of us, as we grew up, I hope it's when we were growing up and not today, thrilled at the exploits of Superman? The Flash. I let that slip. Which is a television series now. Wonder Woman, Batman. These were truly supermen. How great we had thought back in those times to be able to soar above the buildings and to fight crime. Superman can't hold a light, the mythical Superman, to the person of an immortal person. The hope that we have will be much more than men ever imagined such heroes were. Could the saints actually fly? Did you ever hear of anyone spotting a spaceship out in space and a shuttle bringing the angels down to earth? We're told that whatever the angels are is what we shall become. Luke 20, 35 through 37, there was a scenario put before Christ with a hope of trapping him. There were seven brothers. All through the law of Moses had said if a brother died and had no offspring, that his brother must marry the wife and the first child should be named after the first husband. Well, this was a matter of law that the Jews had hoped to catch Jesus in. But he told them, when they asked him which one of those seven brothers would claim this woman, since they all had her, none of them had had children by her, so she went through the course of all seven brothers, having them all for husbands. Now they said, who will be her husband in the kingdom? Whose wife shall she be? But Christ wasn't that easily trapped. He said, you do err not knowing the scriptures. And how many men do that? For they who are accounted worthy to obtain that age neither marry nor are given in marriage, and neither can they die any more. Why? For they are equal unto the angels. And there are at least three places in the scriptures which speak of the saints in the air doing certain things. One is in the 31st chapter of Isaiah, in a prophecy concerning Assyria and a multitude of shepherds being raised against him. And it says, as birds flying will the Lord defend Jerusalem. Now, as we mentioned earlier, everything that God has done in these dispensations of men, he has done through his agents, through angels, priests, prophets, and apostles. Most of all, through his Son, who for 33 and a half years was upon this earth. In the last verse of Isaiah 40, we are told that those that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up as eagles on wings. Not that they themselves will have wings, because angels have visited men when they thought they were just mere men, but they turned out to be angels. So they don't have wings. But it's saying that those that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up as eagles with wings. They shall run and not faint, and walk and not be weary. Brothers and sisters, the time of our mortality is almost over. If we don't make it, we won't be mortal very much longer, because the dead are not mortal, they're dead. If we make it, we'll be able to look back and contrast the past with the then present and be able to agree with the Apostle Paul when he said, I hath not seen nor ear heard, neither hath it entered into the heart of man, the thing that God hath prepared for those that love him.